This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. Sri Lanka's Prime Minister has ordered the military to do whatever's necessary to restore order after protesters stormed his office demanding that he resign. It comes after the country's president escaped to the Maldives. Both leaders had promised to stand down after public anger about the country's crippling economic crisis, but they haven't followed through. Southeast Asia correspondent Mazoe Ford reports from Colombo.
Cheers from anti-government protesters who'd made it past armed soldiers, tear gas and water cannon and scaled high walls to break into the highly fortified office compound of the Sri Lankan Prime Minister. Armed soldiers were outnumbered, so they eventually took a step back and watched as hundreds of unauthorised visitors came flooding in. It's the fourth major government building protesters have occupied here in Colombo since the weekend. Gianna De Souza is one of the protest leaders.
What we needed to breach this building was a large group, so it took quite a long time for that group to amass. And until then, it was a ping-pong battle of tear gas. And at a certain point, the protesters were kind of blocked in on the road where there were water cannons, tear gas being fired.
The 26-year-old says extra people came quickly.
I think through social media, the news got out and then people flooded here and we had enough people to break in, and I would say we were in the first 100 people or so to get into the building.
Sri Lanka's president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, fled for the Maldives yesterday after months of public pressure to resign for financial mismanagement and alleged corruption. His decision to leave his hand-picked Prime Minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe, in charge as acting president, triggered more public anger. Wickremesinghe promises to step down once a new all-party government's in place. But the protesters now occupying his office want him gone now.
They should leave. They should listen to the nation.
We don't know what will happen, but we try to chase them out because we want a new leader.
Political analyst Dr. Parkasuti Zivanamutu can explain what will happen, at least politically.
Within 30 days, Parliament must decide on who amongst the members of Parliament will be elected to serve out Gotabaya Rajapaksa's term. Once that is done, then a new government is formed. And then, of course, I think what the new government ought to do is to abolish the executive presidency and set a timetable for new elections.
In the meantime, Wickremesinghe has declared a state of emergency, while the Chief of Defence, General Chandra Silva, is appealing for calm.
We appeal to the people, especially the youth, to help the armed forces and police maintain peace until the next president is elected.
Protesters say they'll continue to occupy key government buildings until both president and prime minister resign, and they'll keep a close watch on any new leaders to make sure they put the people first. This is Mazoe Ford in Colombo, reporting for AM.
The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is holding a second day of talks with Pacific leaders as the Pacific Islands Forum wraps up in Fiji. Mr. Albanese is expected to press leaders to back his government's push to co-host a major United Nations climate change conference. But the forum is still grappling with the decision from Kiribati to quit the gathering. Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts is in Suva. Stephen, are Pacific leaders likely to back Australia's bid to host a UN climate conference?
Yeah, I think they are. At the very least, I think, Kim, they're going to issue some sort of broad statement of support for Australia's ambition here today. Most Pacific nations have been pretty clear that they'd like Australia to do more on climate, and a commitment like this does signal that the Albanese Labor government does want to do more in this space and wants to encourage greater global ambition. So that's definitely welcome. On the other hand, though, this also presents quite a bit of leverage to Pacific Island nations who have made it clear that whilst they're happy that the new Labor government has introduced more ambitious targets, they still want Australia to go further. Last night, for example, Frank Bainimarama, Fiji's Prime Minister and the chair of the forum, After meeting the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, he tweeted that he'd urged the Prime Minister to go further for our family's shared future by aligning Australia's commitment to the 1.5 degree target. So that's a clear call from Frank Bainimarama for Australia to do more, to go harder and faster with cutting emissions. And I think that's one thing many Pacific leaders will be saying to Mr. Albanese today as he pitches for support for this forum.
So, Stephen, in the meantime, it sounds like efforts to stop Kiribati from leaving the forum aren't working.
No, not at this stage. In fact, yesterday I spoke to the president of Palau, Sarangul Whips. He's another Micronesian leader, and he's been one of those who have been trying to reach the president of Kiribati in the wake of its shock decision to leave the forum. And he told me what we've heard from other Micronesian and Pacific leaders over the last few days. They've been unable to convince him to change track and to stay in the forum because they've simply been unable to get him on the phone. Let's take a listen to Mr. Whips speaking to me from Suva.
There has been no response. President Anamea, and he's tasked with trying to do everything to get a hold of him. He's been reaching out on our behalf. We've tried different ways. I've tried messenger. I think the sooner we can have a dialogue, the better.
So, Stephen, is there a risk that other Pacific countries will quit the forum?
Look, there is still a risk, but I think that risk is now diminishing. I've been told that all Pacific nations, with the exception of Kiribati and Nauru, have now signed on to the Suva Agreement. That was the compromise that was hammered out by Frank Bainimarama, the Fijian Prime Minister and Forum Chair, a few weeks ago to try and keep Micronesian countries in the fold by basically ensuring that the top job in the Pacific Islands Forum is rotated through the three sub-regions in the future. Now, with only two holdouts, and I'm told that Nauru is likely to sign later today, it does look increasingly like the rest of the forum is now going to hold together, leaving only Kiribati out in the cold. And President Whips told me that he believes that there's a will to move forward here. He's urging all countries to make sure they sign on the line and stick with the agreement in order to preserve Pacific unity. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
If that doesn't move forward, that would definitely just...
That would be the end, presumably.
That would be the end. That would be the end. And that would be really breaking the little trust that has been developed, destroying that trust. And so that's why the agreement is so important, because it's about rebuilding trust.
The president of Palau, Sarangul Whips, and before him, our reporter Stephen Jedgetts in Suva. There's been another step towards the creation of a new 10-year national plan to tackle domestic and family violence. The Albanese government has released a long-awaited report from researchers at Monash University, which canvasses the views of nearly 500 experts and could guide the development of the plan. Amanda Rishworth is the Federal Minister for Social Services. Minister, you've previously said that the former government didn't get enough work done on a new national plan. What do you think is lacking?
Well, firstly, the current national plan ended on the 30th of June, and while there's no immediate drop-off in services, the former government had 10 years to know when that deadline is. So as one of my first priorities, I want to make sure that we make progress on the next national plan that will last for 10 years and get something in place. I want to get it right, but with a sense of urgency, get something in place so that states and territories and the Commonwealth are all working in the same direction.
You've released a report that will help guide this process. The researchers who did the report say that they were repeatedly told that a range of different targets or measures need to be developed. So, for example, do you support measuring if there's been a reduction in the number of women dying, a reduction in sexual assaults?
Well, look, I want to work with my state and territory colleagues. This is a whole of government and state and territory. State and territories are part of that. So I want to work with them to make sure that we have a robust plan, that we are, as governments, accountable in the plan, and I will work with them.
I'm just trying to make sure that if you're talking about accountability and robustness, that there are some actual measures and targets in the new plan.
Well, we want to make sure that governments are accountable. As I said, we won't get anywhere if we don't sign off between states and territories and the Commonwealth. So I want to make sure that we are working towards that. But I would say I have released the stakeholder consultation report. This was resisted by the former government. They had no intention of releasing it. I think it's important as we move towards finalising the plan that we have a transparent process and people can all comment and be part of it.
So will that include specific targets?
Well, look, as I said, I'm going to work with my states and territories on what targets as the service deliverers, what targets they might want to see included. And I will be certainly working with them to make sure it's as robust as possible.
Let's talk money. One advocate says that the Albanese government needs to commit $1 billion a year towards filling what she calls black spots in support programs. How much money is going to be set aside in the October budget?
Well, look, firstly, I would say that some of the first actions our government has actually taken is in the area of family and domestic violence. We've signalled one of the first things we're going to do as a legislative program is to put in 10 days family and domestic violence leave. This is really important to ensure that women stay connected with the workplace and they don't lose their jobs when they're leaving violent circumstances. I've also, as a matter of priority, looked at how we can improve the escaping domestic violence payment. That payment hasn't been working for people, but this is why a plan's so important, to make sure that every area is covered from prevention all the way through to recovery.
So are we expecting a big sort of figure in the upcoming budget?
Well, I'll be working with my colleagues about making sure that we do tackle this issue. I think our actions have already shown. I mean, I've been in the job 6 weeks and I've made this one of my first priorities, and our government has as well. And so I think you can see from the actions we've taken, we take this very seriously.
The previous plan, as you said, has expired, so you need to get cracking. Do you think that there could be final agreement when you meet with state and territory ministers late next week?
Well, look, I think this is a really first important step for our government. It's the first meeting that we've had with states and territories. And so we will be having a serious discussion with this. And it will outline the steps of how we finalise the plan and get cracking on the next 10 years, which will indeed need careful planning and careful service delivery.
Minister, thank you very much for speaking with AM.
Thank you.
The Minister for Social Services, Amanda Rishworth. And if you or anyone you know needs help, please call the National Sexual Assault, Domestic and Family Violence Counselling Service on 1800 RESPECT. That's 1800 737 732. As COVID cases rise across the country, it's hoped that making antiviral treatments more widely available will ease some pressure on hospitals. But now peak health bodies are warning that recent changes to the Medicare rebate will prevent some people from accessing them. Isabel Massali reports.
Melbourne GP Dr. Joe Garra has begun prescribing life-saving medication to COVID patients. But it's not easy.
The criteria has now changed to if you're over 70, or if you're over 50 with two risk factors. So then you've got to work out if you've got the risk factors that qualify you. So, and then you've got to decide which, explain to the patient that there are two drugs. Then you've got to go through every medication the patient's on and run it through a checklist and see.
It's a process that can easily run over 20 minutes. And since July 1, these long appointments that are done over the phone are no longer getting a Medicare rebate. Dr. Garra says it puts his patients and clinic in a difficult position.
Once they've tested positive, we don't want them coming in to see us, so we need to be doing telehealth with them. And for the vast majority of people, the phone is the easiest way of doing it. You know, not everyone's got a computer at home with a camera to set up and or know how to do it. You know, there's lots of things that can go wrong with video consults. I know the patients, they know me, so we could actually have a very safe consultation. I don't necessarily have to see them face to face.
The Australian Medical Association and the Royal Australian College of GPs have written to the Federal Health Minister, warning this Medicare rebate is critical in the pandemic and must be restored. AMA President Dr. Omar Khorshid says without it, patients could be left up to $70 out of pocket, particularly affecting vulnerable, elderly and rural Australians.
The inevitable consequence of this cut to Medicare support for telehealth is that less patients will access the antivirals that they need when they need them, and less older and more vulnerable Australians will be able to access the healthcare that they've gotten used to over the last few months. That risks putting more pressure on hospitals, and it risks more people getting sick with COVID just at the time when Omicron is surging again through the community and we're seeing people getting infected for the second time and tens of thousands of cases every single day.
He says the pandemic is still a huge challenge, but the public is getting mixed messages.
On one level, the impending surge in cases is being called out. People are being told to expect significant rises in case numbers, significant rises in the number of people in hospital. But on the other hand, supports for managing the pandemic, such as the telehealth Medicare rebates, the pandemic leave, support for free rapid antigen tests for eligible Australians, these are being pulled just at the time when the government's telling us we need to watch out more for COVID.
In a statement, Federal Health Minister Mark Butler said 6 out of 7 telehealth consults last less than 20 minutes. And if it goes beyond that, Australians can still speak to their doctor from home with FaceTime or video call. He also urged people to plan for what they'll do if they get COVID and speak to a doctor about their options before it happens.
Isabella Massali reporting. 4 months after a funeral insurance company collapsed, leaving thousands of First Nations customers out of pockets, new data sheds light on the communities worst affected by the company's liquidation. Some paid more than $1 million, despite being among the country's most economically disadvantaged areas. Here's Indigenous Affairs reporter Kirsty Wellauer.
When Allenby Ambram was growing up in far north Queensland, he didn't care too much about money.
Yarrabah is a beautiful place. We scared hunting, dragging net, we get prawns along the beach and all the fish around here, and hunting out in the bush, camping. That sort of all died down, you know, like we had to look for a job and we found a job, you know, and tried to hold it for a long time and keeping our family safe.
For Allenby, part of looking after his family was planning for his funeral. For years, he's been paying funeral insurer the Aboriginal Community Benefit Fund, later known as UPLA. In March, the company went into liquidation, leaving more than 14,500 First Nations Australians with no cover.
I got angry, very angry. I said, why did they come here and do that? We just are people battling, just like everybody else.
Now, data released by the liquidators, SV Partners, to financial counsellors Mobstrong Debt Help, shows the residents of Yarrabah, a former missionary town, paid more than $1.7 million to UPLA over the years, the second most of any postcode in the country. Mobstrong's Bettina Cooper says more than 760 people had policies with the company.
I would be surprised if you could walk down a street in Yarrabah and not find a house that has not been affected by the collapse of ACBF.
Yarrabah is the seventh most disadvantaged town in Australia. And Bettina says this will put them further behind.
They've now got to pay for family funerals, will cause further intergenerational debt and certainly sustain them as one of the lowest socioeconomic areas.
In New South Wales, Gwen Newman is one of hundreds of people in Moree who have been paying the company for decades. Over the years, the community has paid more than $2.2 million, more than any other place in the country.
Yeah, I feel the pressure, and so do all the community feel the pressure now that there's no money available to bury us now.
The company has been subject to a number of regulatory actions over its 30-year history.
The government was aware there was a problem and they stopped them from selling further products, but they did nothing to put a hedge of protection around those who were already involved in the product.
The data, which includes people who cancelled their policies or died after 2017, shows communities in New South Wales and Queensland were the most affected.
We know that there's 10,000 people from Queensland in the current data. We know there's 8,000 from New South Wales in the current data. And we know there's 1,000 from Victoria. We know that it's not all of the ACBF members.
The government has promised an inquiry into what happened at UPLA, but it's unclear when that will happen. For Gwen, she wants compensation, ensuring she can be buried with dignity.
I'd like the government to step in and help us with our money back so we can get buried. At least we'd be all at peace.
Moree resident Gwen Newman, ending that report by Kirsty Wellauer. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers. Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The BA4 and BA5 subvariants of Omicron are leading to a concerning jump in infections here and all around the world. Today, US virologist Jeremy Camille on when Omicron-specific vaccines will be ready and which nations will get them first. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.